The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good morning. This is Greg Roman on the Middle East Forum Radio Hour on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk Radio. Today, April 29th, 2020, has seen the Middle East erupt in flames overnight as a majority, if not all, of the banks in Lebanon have been burned to the ground. Riots in Gulf Tripoli last night, protesters torching several banks in an army vehicle as soldiers used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowds. One demonstrator died in the violence. This reduction in citizens' purchasing power due to the Lebanese pound losing more than half of its value since last October has caused widespread anger. Hezbollah's deputy leader, Sheikh Nassim Karim, said in a Tuesday interview with the group's Al Noor Radio, accumulated errors and a negative performance from the central bank led us to this result, and the governor of the central bank bears the responsibility, but not on his own. The Hezbollah-supported Prime Minister, Hassan Diab, in a Friday speech, blamed long-serving central bank governor Riyad Salameh for the Lebanese pound's depreciation and reportedly seeks his ouster. Over the weekend, however, Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri and Maronite Patriarch Bashar al-Arakhi came to Salameh's defense. In Libya, the Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar ruling out in a televised statement Monday further dialogue with the Tripoli-based government of National Accord, saying the LNA would create its own permanent civic institutions. Receiving pushback Tuesday from Haftar's Russian patron, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who told reporters that just as Moscow rejects the GNA's refusal to negotiate with the LNA commander, he says, "We do not support the statement that now Marshal Haftar will decide unilaterally the way for the Libyan people to live." Also on Tuesday, the LNA accused a Turkish drone of killing at least five civilians in an attack on a food truck convoy. Turkish air power has changed the balance of power between the LNA and GNA forces in western Libya in recent weeks. Moving to Syria, Turkey's defense ministry blamed a bomb-rigged fuel tanker in Afrin, which killed 40 civilians, on the Kurdish-led YPG. However, no one has claimed responsibility, and the YPG claims not to target civilians. The Turkish military and allied militias wrested control of the city from the autonomous Kurdish administration in northern Syria in March of 2018. We also see that in Syria, Israeli Defense Minister Naftali Bennett Tuesday seemed to confirm Israel's responsibility for Monday's airstrikes on a military airfield outside Damascus that killed four pro-Iranian fighters and three civilians. Bennett issued a statement saying, "We have moved from blocking Iran's entrenchment in Syria to forcing it out of there, and we will not stop." Moving on to Iran, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom on Tuesday published its 2020 annual report, which documented Iran, quote, "a particular uptick in the persecution of Baha'is and local government officials who supported them in 2019. It also quotes U.S. Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, Ilan Carr, calling Iran the world's chief trafficker in anti-Semitism and claiming that anti-Semitism is an ancillary to the ideology of the Islamic Republic. It is the central foundational component of the ideology of that regime." Iranian police last week arrested the editor-in-chief and a social media administrator of Iran's semi-official ILNA news agency for a cartoon mocking Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei by portraying him as a nurse, seemingly silencing those objecting to those questioning quack treatments for COVID-19 promoted by some Iranian clerics, such as drinking camel excrement and inserting violet oil in the nether regions. Tehran's prosecutor Ali Al-Ghassi Mehr announced Monday the launching of an investigation into the affair. Really, these things that are going on right now in Iran just is beyond the pale of imagination. I cannot imagine a country which has suffered so much, its people being entrenched by this radical ideology of revolutionary, of so-called revolutionary thought. But the only thing that's revolutionary about what the Iranians are doing is how backwards the country is becoming. A proud Persian nation, which for thousands of years was a light of hope and a beacon of prosperity and advancement in technology and of a proud people, has now been withered down to this ancillary, anachronistic, despotic regime. It's time for the Iranians to wake up and to start taking care of business in their own country. I'm sick of having to just come on this show every week and say, you know what? It's the Ayatollah's fault. No. In Iran, the situation is largely dependent on what the people are able to do. To say that it's this ongoing internecine battle between what they call the reformers and then what we also refer to as the theocrats. It's not the reformers and the three theocrats who are going against each other. It's anyone who is part of the regime and anyone who is outside of that regime. And this misnomer that the people are stuck in the middle is just a notion that I don't buy. My point here is that I think in order for us to find a modicum of a path forward in Iran, it's not just that the Ayatollah has to go, the whole regime has to go. But it should not be dependent on the United States pursuing regime change. It has to be dependent on the people of Iran, the Persian people, finding a way to change within. Now, can the U.S. support that from the outside? Yes. But the real challenge here is how are the Iranian people going to wake up and how are they going to find a way to meet that challenge? And we'll discuss that more later on in the program. In Israel, Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, Esther Chayut, announced Tuesday that 11 out of the court's 15 justices will hear next Sunday and Monday 8 petitions filed against a coalition agreement with Likud and Blue and White. That's the former opposition party, now the party that seems to be joining with Netanyahu to form a what they call a national union government, on the legitimacy of a indicted person's right to form a government. So is someone in Israel who's under indictment able to form a government and become prime minister? He was elected by the people, so I don't know. It's the justice's burden or the judicial burden versus that of the people's choice. And let's say for a second, Netanyahu has not been convicted of any crime yet. So it's an interesting question. Blue and White and Likud each issued statements calling on the High Court of Justice to dismiss the petitions to avoid usurping powers belonging to the Knesset, and according to the Likud statement, overriding the voters' will. In the Palestinian Authority, right next door to Israel, the World Bank on Monday approved a U.S. $14 million grant as part of a multi-phase advanced sustainability in performance infrastructure and reliability of energy sector program, that's the Aspire program, to improve operational and financial performance of the Palestinian electricity institutions and diversification of energy sources. Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, France, Finland, Sweden, Croatia, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and Australia are expected to supply an additional $49 million to upgrade the power generating capacity of the Palestinians. And in Qatar, there's really this news story of corruption coming out of Qatar each and every week. The Paris Saint-Germain football club president, Nasser Al-Khalifa, former FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valky, and an unnamed third defendant will stand trial in a Swiss federal court next September for awarding broadcast rights in exchange for the rights for the 2026 and 2030 World Cups to Al-Khalifi's beIN Sports Network in exchange for using a luxury villa owned by one of Al-Khalifi's companies. Qatari Emir Tamim bin Hamad Al-Thani appointed the billionaire Al-Khalifi as a minister without portfolio in 2013. Wonder if he has diplomatic immunity. And last, in Saudi Arabia, Hatice Sanjiz, the fiancé of murdered journalist and Jamal Khashoggi, sent a letter through her lawyers to the Premier League seeking to block Saudi Arabia's public investment fund from acquiring an 80% stake in the Newcastle United Football Club due to the kingdom's role in murder of Khashoggi. We'll see if that stands in the way of seeing that. And there's actually one more story here. ISIS. French prosecutors are opening a terrorism investigation into a suspect only identified as Yusuf T, who plowed a BMW into a police traffic stop Monday, leaving two officers hospitalized with leg fractures. The suspect was carrying a letter swearing allegiance to the terror organization. After these messages, we'll be joined by the opinion editor of the Jerusalem Post, speaking about Israel Independence Day, Mr. Seth Franzman.
The intellectual backbone of American Middle East studies has provided a rationable excuse for individuals trying to promote an anti-American agenda. We see that those individuals who are in Islamic studies and American Middle East studies programs at some of the most major American universities find themselves justifying the behavior of America's enemies overseas and promoting domestic threats that harm us here at home. If you want to go and learn more about Campus Watch, the Reader's Digest of American Middle East Studies, check us out on Campus Watch at www.campus-watch.org.
This is a public service announcement test from TakeMeFishing.org to determine if you need a fishing license and boat registration before heading out on the water. Let's begin. Are you a bear? Do you have a beak? Does your name rhyme with Ald Beagle? Do you dart in front of cars? Here's a tough one. Do you have plumage? Do you rub your body against things to mark them? Do you have webbed feet? No, I mean like a... Were you hatched? Do you have fur? I'm not talking back hair. Does your boat fly south for the winter with the other boats? Regardless of how you answer, you need to be licensed and registered because it helps local conservation efforts protect the very natural resources you enjoy boating and fishing in for generations to come. Do your part at TakeMeFishing.org.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk. While we wait for Seth Fransman to join us, I'd like to share something that we went over in the last few days here in the both the city in Philadelphia and also over the station. And we're going to bring to you right now a fascinating public service message that I really think is going to be something that is a different commercial that we usually bring. And the board operator is going to play two or three more commercials. And in doing so, we're going to set the stage for what I think is going to be a great interview with Mr. Fransman. So, Jason, why don't we play those messages and we'll be right back.
Fascism was a danger to American interests in the early 20th century, communism in the last half of that century. And in the 21st century, we find our new ideological enemy, Islamism. Islamist Watch argues that violence is not the only or even the best way to apply Islamist ideas in Western liberal democracies. Islamist Watch monitors and exposes the growing influence of non-violent radical Islamist groups in the West while empowering moderate Muslims. Radical Islam is the problem. Mainstream Islam is the solution. Read more at www.islamist-watch.org or check us out on Twitter at Islamist Watch.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that, overall, you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't seen your lap in months. And even more stuff. But still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed. And they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs. And it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff. Create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM, Philadelphia Talk. I'm Greg Roman, your host. We have Marilyn Stern and Gary Gamble, our two members of the production team. And we are joined by Seth Franzman, the op-ed editor and Middle East Affairs analyst at the Jerusalem Post, and also a contributor to Defense News, The National Interest, and the Digest of Middle East Studies. His current interests include regional security, Kurdish issues, refugees, the history of the Holy Land, Bedouin, and land laws. Seth is also from the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis, and we are proud to have him on as a Middle East Forum Fellow here on the radio. Seth, happy Israel Independence Day.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So what are you doing to celebrate in this limited confinement of 500 meters from your house? Or maybe you actually get the opportunity to go a little bit beyond that because you're a member of the press.
That's right. Well, as a journalist, if we carry a press card, we're allowed to go where we want, but it doesn't really help us in a sense on a day like this because there's a total lockdown here. So there's just no one in the streets. I mean, it's like one of those movies where you wake up and there's no people left or something. So, but they did have a flyby today of a bunch of planes flying over the hospitals throughout Israel, including where I am in Jerusalem, and flying low over the hospitals to show support for the medical staff. So we happened to go out in the streets near one of the hospitals named Shaar Tzedek, and we saw the planes flying over, which was fun for the family. And then other than that, we just had a small low-key barbecue at home. So not like in usual years when everyone's in the parks and barbecuing.
So my kids, you know, my wife's Israeli, and I guess I am too, but American by, you know, American first, Israeli second, whatever you want to say. But we had the concert, which was broadcast from the studio of Infected Mushroom last night on Israel's Ynet online news station. And there was a concert going on. So we actually got to feel as if though just a small little bit closer to being near Israel than we were in previous years, especially as now that we're in the United States. I think it's been 8 years since I've been to a Yom HaTzmaut celebration in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but I digress. Israel, 72 yeah. years old. What is the country's status looking for the next year?
This year? Well, I think it looks like there's going to be hopefully a new government or a coalition government after like three elections. And that will mean, you know, continued rule by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is supposed to have a trial this year as well. I think that, you know, he's going to do everything he can to kind of cling on to power. And I think if we look at the long track record of Netanyahu, I mean, it's been certainly a stable period. There are some question marks coming up in terms of annexation, although it's not entirely clear, you know, if he'll want to go through with that annexation, because that's something that certainly the center right wants to do. But, you know, he's also fallen out a bit with some of the parties that have a lot of constituency in the West Bank. So it's not entirely clear he'll have the guts to do that. And then, you know, the other question mark, obviously, is what happens with the Iran tensions. And I think that we continue to see Syrian media reporting that Israel's, carrying out airstrikes. So those tensions are there, but I don't think that Iran or Hezbollah wants a real conflict. So we may continue to see this kind of war of attrition or whatever exactly is taking place in Syria.
Now, understanding Iran's, I was going to say, understanding Iran's imprint across the Middle East really is part of your bailiwick of what you bring to the analysis you write about on a day in, day out basis. An article you put up in the Jerusalem Post today, actually, it was probably just about 6 or 7 hours ago. Its headline is, "A rift emerges among pro-Iranian militias in Iraq." Can we take a sort of a tour, if you will, between Lebanon, Syria, and Iran? Excuse me, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. And can you give us a brief analysis of what is Iran's state on the backdrop of other regional affairs? So how is Iran dealing with the Lebanese banking crisis? How's it dealing with the issue? And I think this is underreported, but what's going on with the attacks against its forces in Syria, and how is it dealing with internecine challenges with its imprint in Iraq?
Well, it looks like, I think, the way you could think of Iran is it's often depicted as a kind of octopus. And in some ways, you know, Iran has had an extraordinary kind of track record of, in its own view, success of slowly digesting kind of parts of Iraq after 2003, and also Lebanon in the 80s and 90s. Obviously, Iran thrives on weak states or crisis or civil wars, and it manages to kind of gobble up pieces of countries, and it invests in the long term. So, you know, a lot of these guys that are parts of Hezbollah or pro-Iranian groups, they've been working with Iran for decades. And I think that's one thing that Western policymakers kind of don't understand often is that, you know, the United States thinks there's a quick fix often to things in the Middle East, which is, well, we just go in there and we throw some money at it or we topple a dictator like Saddam and things will change. And Iran tends to say, well, what will happen in 50 years? So, you know, if you all those countries you mentioned, Iran has a long-term project. But one of the things that's happened in recently, as you mentioned, the kind of crisis in Lebanon with the budget or the problems they're having in Iraq now that I wrote about today about the rift between the militias, is that Iran is a bit overextended. I mean, Iran doesn't have a massive economy. It's not like China. It doesn't have an endless supply of weapons. It has a lot of human, you know, obviously human resources in a sense in these countries because it has people that are mostly Shiites and clerics who deeply love Iran. But in the end of the day, these people are not economists and they can't do everything. So Lebanon is in a sense falling apart. It doesn't have a lot of money. A lot of the money is going abroad. Syria has been hollowed out by the civil war. And Iraq had this war against ISIS. Iraq's infrastructure is falling apart. And this huge group of people, this Hashd al-Shaabi, or popular mobilization units, which are pro-Iranian militias, think of them like a National Guard or, you know, Hezbollah, you know, multiplied by 10 or something.
Right.
These groups are very, very important. They definitely exist everywhere. But they can't do everything, and that's right. They can't solve the economic crisis, and they can't solve the kind of reality of Iraq's crisis, which is that you have a divided country between Kurds and Sunni Arabs and other groups. And so I think that that's where Iran is running up into a whole bunch of obstacles. It looks like it's this giant octopus, and it certainly is more effective than almost any other country in the region. That's definitely true in terms of kind of exerting its power and influence. But it's running into the fact that it's gonna maybe grown too big.
Now, it's not just that it's grown too big. It's former the captain of the ship was taken out at the beginning of the year, and his main point person in Iraq was with him. Can you talk about the effect of the Qasem al-Soleimani assassination now 4 months later, what that means for the organization, the logistics, and the reception of a recent visit by the new head of the IRGC's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Quds al-Quds Division's Extraterritorial Operations Division to Iraq that took place a few weeks ago? It didn't go so well for him, I understand.
So I think that what's interesting here is that Qasem Soleimani and the guy he was with, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, these were two close friends, and these men had worked together, you know, for many, many, many years, back until the 1980s. And if we have to remember that they're part of a kind of coterie of other people like Imam Munia, who used to be a member of Hezbollah, who was also killed years ago in 2008. These guys, you know, they grew up together, they had a worldview, and they worked very closely so that Iran could extend its power into Iraq. And in the last few years, after the United States had gone back to Iraq to help defeat ISIS, these groups that are pro-Iranian decided to target U.S. forces in the context of the U.S.-Iran tensions and the U.S. walking away from the deal. And they eventually ended up killing Americans and then, of course, trying to storm the embassy, if we all recall that, at the end of last year. So Donald Trump took the initiative of killing both of them, which I think no one expected. And Iran has been a bit on the back foot. I mean, Iran tried to fire these – it did fire ballistic missiles at a U.S. base, but they didn't kill anyone. If we compare that to what the Iranian militias were doing in 2005, 6, 7, 8, where they were killing Americans, I think that we notice Iran is now very reticent to actually kill Americans in Iraq. And of course, the United States has also been very prudent in withdrawing from certain bases and also sending air defense and things like that. So, you know, Iraq is kind of in play in a sense. But as you mentioned, the guy who came after Qasem Soleimani, because the Iranian octopus is really about people and it's about the power of building up people-to-people relationships, when you kill a key person, all of a sudden, all the people around him don't have that kind of shared person to work with. And so the killing of Qasem Soleimani and the guy who came in, this new guy, Ismail Ghani, who's actually a guy who's an expert in Afghan stuff and Afghan relations with Iran, he's just not respected in Iraq. And it seems that what we're seeing now is that this kind of careful let's say, structure that Iran built, having pulled out kind of parts of the building has shaky foundations and parts of it look like they're going to fall in different directions, which means you'll have groups in Iraq that are very close to Iran, which will stay close to Iran, and then groups that are closer to the kind of Shiite religious establishment in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani, and those groups will coalesce around shrines and those things and become more of a local Iraqi force. That may happen. So it's interesting that sometimes killing a key person, taking them out of the equation, really does, you know, totally transform something and make it mean that if you killed bin Laden, for instance, back in, you know, 1999, there just wouldn't have been 9/11 probably. Sometimes a key figure is that important.
But on the other hand, and I don't want to point to a potential adverse consequence of what happened with killing Soleimani, when Israel took out the founder of Hezbollah in the early 90s, in exchange, we got Hassan Nasrallah. So sometimes an assassination brings an even more devilish and sinister figure. But in this case, I mean, 4 months on, it seems as if though the Iranians are tying themselves in knots and they don't know what to do. But the potential for someone worse to come out is always still there. That's always the consequence that you have associated with targeted assassinations and targeted killings. Let's go in Iran for a second. It can't really find its center point since the Soleimani assassination. What's happening in the country because of the coronavirus?
Iran has thousands of deaths, almost 100,000 cases of the virus, at least officially. I think the number is, most people think it's a lot more. Iran was one of the earliest countries to be hit in terms of the region and the world, in fact. The virus spread to the religious city of Qom and then to Tehran in early February and then mid-February. So Iran has a huge outbreak of the virus. Iran has deployed the army and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to fight the virus. So I think I was reading today that the army, just the army itself, is involved in fighting the virus in 58 hospitals and has provided 10,000 beds and 30,000 medical staff. So this is obviously, if you look through the numbers, you say, well, wait, that's a lot. So obviously this is a big problem for Iran. Iran wants to kind of play this double game of kind of hiding how big a problem is, but while at the same time the foreign minister continues to say that U.S. sanctions are like responsible for the spread of the virus, wants to be both the victim and the conqueror at the same time. I think that the reality is, you know, look, oil prices are very low. Iran's regime doesn't have a lot of money. It has to fight the virus. At the end of the day, even if 10 or 20,000 people die in Iran, Iran can survive that. I mean, Iran survived the war against Iraq in the 80s in which Iranians were gassed and things. So it can survive the casualties. But I think it does, of course, clip the wings of that country a bit. And that's why you're seeing the regime talk a lot about new technology, like drone technology that they're building, because the regime wants to say, look, what you see, you know, we're under these sanctions, we have the virus, we're still building all these drones. Right. Well, you can still build drones because they're not very big. But the country, I think, has serious, serious problems. It doesn't look like the regime itself is threatened, because I think the regime has survived these kind of difficulties for decades. It's built on this kind of crisis mode.
And one of the last things I want to ask you, we have about 2 minutes left, is I like to ask our guests to sometimes act as prophets. A year from now, what do you see Iran and its position in the region? Same, or do you think they're keeping on teetering and tottering until it reaches a tipping point?
I don't think there will be a tipping point, but I think that Iran does not have an answer to the problems it has stirred up throughout the region, which is that there is no Iranian long-term solution to Lebanon. I mean, Iran can continue to, you know, use its Hezbollah proxies there and stockpile weapons, but you can only stockpile weapons so long. What are you eventually going to do with them? They're not going to take over Lebanon. In Syria, Iran has a regime that's an ally, but Syria has been totally destroyed by war, and it will take Syria decades to recover, even if it gets financing from China and places like that. And Iraq, you know, Iraq is also a total economic disaster. So how is it? Iran never seems to build anything in these countries. It doesn't build universities. Doesn't build something that looks like the Gulf states. So I would say that a year from now, I don't see that there will be. I don't think there will be a big difference. And I don't think that Iran has an answer to all these question marks. It's true that the West doesn't have an answer either, in the sense that there is no way to pry Lebanon loose from Hezbollah, or no magic wand that will make Iraq into a U.S. ally again or something like that. That's not going to happen either. But I think that I don't see how anything can possibly change in the year. I think the processes will continue, in which these countries will continue to be unstable, and countries like Iraq and Lebanon will be more and more divided. And I don't think they will collapse, because I don't think that anyone in these countries, they survived difficulties in the past. They don't tend to collapse. I don't think there will be another rise of ISIS like there was before, but I think we will see an increase or uptick in ISIS and in jihadist types of attacks, just not the kind of thing we saw in 2014.
Seth Frantzman, editor and Middle East Forum fellow, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Happy Independence Day over in Israel. After these messages, Steve Emerson, director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism.
The Israel Victory Project steers U.S. policy toward backing an Israel victory over the Palestinians to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Decades of what insiders call peace processing have left matters worse than where they started. The time has come for a new approach, a complete rethinking of the problem that draws on Israel's earlier and successful strategy of deterrence. Stop pressuring Jerusalem to compromise and make painful concessions. Instead, support Israeli victory, convincing Palestinians and others that the Jewish state will endure. Read more at meforum.org.
During the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. After World War II, they called it Gross Stress Reaction. It's been called Shell Shock, War Neurosis, and Battle Fatigue. Today, we call it Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not a wound that you can see, though it can have an even more significant impact. Post-traumatic stress disorder can prevent warriors from living a normal life, hurt their relationships, and affect their ability to hold a steady job. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with post-traumatic stress disorder and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out what you can do to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM. And I have been waiting for the better part of 2 years to have our next guest on our program. Stephen Emerson is considered one of the leading authorities on Islamic extremist networks, financing and operations, as well as national security and intelligence. He is the executive director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, a nonprofit organization that maintains one of the world's largest storehouses of archival data and intelligence on Islamic and Middle Eastern terrorist groups. He's known, and he came to prominence in 1994 with the broadcast of his documentary film, Jihad in America, with the Investigative Project being launched the year thereafter. Steve, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Greg. I'm glad you could read my PR. So,
anything we can do for IPT, we're your biggest fan.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Nice to be with you this morning.
Steve, what's the greatest terrorist threat facing the United States today, coming from the Middle East or from within our own country?
No, I think it's, the greatest threat has been the freelance, self-anointed ISIS, Al-Qaeda type that wants to carry out an attack on behalf of the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, or some amorphous group, connected to the Islamic State, similar to the attacks that have been occurring in France and Paris that has not gotten any notice in the New York Times, of course, but which has really put a chill down the spines of many people, citizens of France, because there have been at least a half a dozen terrorist attacks in Paris or in the suburbs of Paris just in the last month of Islamic terrorism. And in the last 6 months, a Muslim policeman, killed fellow colleagues in a police station. They just discovered yesterday that he was pledged to ISIS. So the ISIS threat is greater in Europe, because that's where more European Muslims have volunteered and returned to. But we still have a situation in the United States where there's an active investigation in every single state. Actually, there are probably about 1,300 open investigations of ISIS-related terrorist activities in the United States at any one time in the last 2 years. And that's the biggest threat. Not all of them necessarily are aimed at plots in the U.S. Some, of course, are aimed at support for material support for plots against other states in the Middle East. But many of them, or some of them, definitely are connected to plots here. Just an arrest yesterday, there was a plot connected to an attack in the United States. So, you know, that is the biggest threat. Now, the FBI has been very successful, well, I almost might say too successful in a sarcastic way, because the public can't imagine the devastation. It can when a terrorist attack occurs, but when it doesn't, it feels very safe and doesn't feel threatened. And therefore, other threats sort of emerge as the greater ones. And I'm not minimizing the threat of right-wing neo-Nazi or right-wing supremacy. That's a major threat as well. And that has surfaced, obviously, with the two synagogue shootings and other arrests. And the FBI now has put additional resources on that. But to the extent that the media or certain civil rights groups claim that the right-wing supremacist threat is the greatest threat we've ever faced and downplay the Islamist threat, they are obviously advancing an ideological bias. It's very dangerous. And you can speak to FBI people, and they'll tell you that very openly. But that's part of the new progressive intersectionalist ideology of downplaying any Islamist threat. In fact, even legitimizing radical Islamist groups that have connections to terrorist organizations. That's the biggest problem I see.
Right, and the Investigative Project on Terrorism, under your auspices, has been able to create these maps and these more fundamental understandings of all the layers that go into creating Islamist networks. You know, when you have, you know, two or three hooples that are down in southern Alabama discussing what it's going to be like to go outside and maybe try to burn a cross in their front yard, but they can't even find the propane to do it. That's what you talk about with right-wing terrorism in terms of its lack of sophistication. But the work that IPT does and the work that other similar-minded organizations does finds that there's ideological underpinnings. There's logistic networks. Like you said just now, material support. And there is a whole web of these different connecting nodes that form the network that eventually lead to that attack. And that's where the FBI has been successful. They take out the different nodes that contribute to these mass terror attacks.
Well, you're 100% right there. I mean, on different levels. For example, on the crudest level, the lone wolf, that's where the self-anointed right-wing neo-Nazi type extremist is equivalent to the lone wolf type, like the guy who shot up the Pulse nightclub in Florida, takes it upon himself to pledge to ISIS. But then again, at a layer above that, you will see much more sophisticated operations that are designed to carry out attacks on a long-range basis with much greater sophistication that involves strategic planning and in types of planning that take a couple of years sometimes over several countries and involvement of money fundraising with different areas of the world involved. Hezbollah, for example, raises money in close to 67 countries, according to the latest U.S. International Customs reports. 67 countries. Now, it doesn't all go to terrorism, because Hezbollah's got a big operational budget that's designed to sort of a state within a state, provide social services as well. But that's what terrorist groups, good terrorist groups do, like the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, Hezbollah. They form a social industry to, as an aggregate, to attract supporters. And that's what they envelop their terrorist group in. And then when people accuse them of terrorism, they say, no, we just provide social services like the Muslim Brotherhood. But in fact, the kernel of their organization and their mission is to carry out terrorism. To legitimize their operations, they wrap it around social missions. Now, those groups still operate, not as much anymore in the United States, because of the crackdown since 9/11. And in the wake of 9/11, the IPT provided to the White House open source on at least 20 front groups that were raising money for terrorist organizations, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Al-Qaeda, and several others. And that resulted in the White House being able to actually freeze the assets of those groups and ultimately shut them down and prosecute half of them, some of them, including the Holy Land Foundation, whose members went to prison for life. The reason the White House came to us was that the CIA had the information to shut it down but couldn't disclose it because it was classified. We had open source intelligence we had been collecting for at least a decade before that we could give them, and that's what they used. That's what the Office of Foreign Assets Control used to disclose, which they had to publicly by law, in order to shut down those organizations.
Now, we're 12 years after Holy Land. What is the new nexus between, we're just talking about progressive and Islamist organizations trying to provide another level of support for indoctrination, for convincing, for basically giving a fig leaf for these organizations to continue to operate territory? So they're not directly funding jihadi groups in Israel, the West Bank, or the territories anymore. But the work that IPT has done has now exposed a whole new funding network of other terror organizations overseas that still have an anti-American agenda.
Well, there still actually are some groups in the U.S. We just discovered this. I'm going to be careful what I say because the discovery has led to a preliminary criminal investigation because of the nature of the evidence. But there are still groups that have 501c3 status, which is nonprofit treasury status, tax-deductible status that nonprofit groups get, and that traditionally terrorist front groups had gotten, like the Holy Land Foundation, to raise money and then to smuggle it or launder it to Hamas or to Jihad or to Hezbollah or to Al-Qaeda overseas. We just discovered a new conduit of a group, a network of groups operating under a name that you would not have known. It was unsuspecting. And this is because there is a real weakness in the system. And that weakness is that anybody can apply for a nonprofit status under any name, create any mission. Treasury has a division only designed to approve or disapprove of those applications. They do not do the sophisticated background counterintelligence, counterterrorism investigations to look at behind that group. For example, when Holy Land Foundation was shut down, a new group arose that had a similar mission but had different names, a different address. It turned out that the people who incorporated it, and we discovered this a year afterwards, were the wives or the husbands of those who had been convicted under their maiden names or their in-laws, and they used their home addresses rather than their office addresses. And we plugged this information into a link analysis chart, and we found out that it was the actual same group, but they use different names, legitimate names. Now, this would not have been the Treasury Department because that division wouldn't have investigated it. The other divisions would have. Now, that's always been a problem in the U.S. government of different divisions within departments not even connecting the dots. That's one of the reasons why 9/11 happened. It's better today than it was. But we still have a situation in DHS where the two divisions required to vet people coming into the country, one overseas, one in the United States within DHS, don't communicate with one another. And so if an applicant from, let's say, Syria is trying to get asylum, will be vetted by some division of DHS overseas, and if there's no social media background, they have nothing to go on. The UN gets involved, and of course the UN will allow anyone in, including bin Laden's children if they were wrong. And then there's an argument by somebody at DHS saying, well, let's hold on. But I can tell you one vignette that will scare you, and I'll be brief about it. About a year ago, an applicant to the FBI, I won't tell you what office, wanted to apply for an FBI position, and he got the position. And his name was brought to my attention. I said, that person was killed in 1992, right before the bombing of the first World Trade Center bombing. He was a member of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman's circle. I said, how could he be alive today and apply for it? Now, it turned out it was his son who applied, who had gone back to Egypt, came back to the U.S., applied for a job, and still believed that his father and the blind sheikh were innocent, and he was made head of a counterterrorist division. And you ask me, how could this happen in the year 2009?
I don't know. It seems as if, though, that there is a lack of tracking, you know, the generational and the familial connections between these people. They don't do the proper background check besides going to a credit reporting agency and maybe seeing if the guy has any outstanding debts or a criminal record. I mean, this is also indicative, Steve, of something that is a much deeper ingrained problem in the U.S. government, which is that I think maybe they've gotten a little bit lazy since 9/11 happened. They're a little bit war-weary. They're not so much trying to focus on the next generation of threats which face us, which still have the same ideological underpinnings, but are coming at it from a much more sophisticated angle, even from the Bin Laden and the Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi groups. You know, and you said this before, it's not just the lone wolf attack, but there's these new networks which are forming, which are starting to create ideological underpinnings. What is the government doing to fight them?
There's an uneven sophistication. The Inspector General of the FBI wrote the report about a month or two ago, a review of counterterrorist investigations into six jihadi attacks during the Obama administration. Attacks that you and I are familiar with, from, you know, Fort Hood to the Pulse nightclub, Marathon. All, by the way, none of them were referred to jihadi attacks at the time under the Obama administration. They were referred to as workplace accidents or some other euphemism, right? So finally, the FBI did refer to them as jihadi attacks. But what was frightening and shocking about this investigation was that in every single case, this was not known, the FBI actually had investigated each of those terrorist suspects ahead of the terrorist attacks, at least 6 months to a year, on the basis of suspicion of being involved in terrorism, and closed out those investigations and said there was nothing there. And then soon, within 6 months, each one of those suspects carried out lethal, murderous attacks. And it showed the problems within the FBI of not fully carrying out comprehensive investigations. It was pretty shocking. And it also opened up the FBI to civil lawsuits by the families, which unfortunately, you know, I feel badly for the FBI agents, because it's not their real fault. It's the problem of headquarters that under the Obama administration decided to take away the training required to investigate radical Islam. What do I mean by that? They took away, they deleted, and they burned and destroyed every single book, every single PowerPoint, every single pamphlet, every single piece of literature that was considered, quote, offensive to Muslims. And that meant tens of thousands of pieces of PowerPoints, many unclassified, on radical Islam that were destroyed, including just articles defining what jihad was. So in the end, you had young coming through the system who didn't know what jihad was. Those who investigated the Boston Marathon bombers before they carried out the attack saw that they were on sites looking at jihad. And to them, what did jihad mean? In love. They weren't schooled on what the definition was. That's what happened under the administration. I fault them for murderously redacting, destroying, and censoring the educational base requirements needed to investigate radical Islam. Period. End of story.
Now, how has that changed under the Trump administration?
I can tell you that it has not changed that much. been a disappointment, a major disappointment. Look, I like the FBI. I mean, on a personal level, I'm very friendly with agents on the ground. And further you get away, you know, from 10th and Pennsylvania, you know, the better the agent and the easier it is to talk to them. But nevertheless, the fact is that Ray really has he is still invoking the same stand. He hasn't reversed any of the bad decisions made by, you know, by Mueller under Obama. None of the, in other words, he hasn't restored the educational material on radical Islam. He hasn't restored the training to how to be informants. Under the Obama administration, they cut the budget in the FBI on counterterrorist informants. Under the Obama administration, in the Washington field office of the FBI, they took away the mission of tracking Hamas and Hezbollah. They just took it away, and they dispersed it. When you disperse a mission like that, it gets carried out by bits and pieces, and really doesn't get carried out. So that hasn't been restored. Where he has been more effective has been when he's been put on the hot seat as a result of the totally unlawful and corrupt investigation against the Trump administration by pipes within the top FBI, and he was forced to do that in changing the FISA criminal acts that were done in changing even the FISA applications. FISA meaning applications to tap telephones of U.S. citizens that were illegal. But bottom line on the other areas, look, I will tell you this. They're doing a good job in terms of investigating ISIS. I'll give you credit. I give them credit, and I give them good credit investigating Hezbollah. Hezbollah's extensive network, probably the group with the largest network around the world, with those who are either agents of the Hezbollah or agents of Iran, and or subcontractors, whatever, collecting intelligence or providing material support. And collecting material parts for nuclear facilities or for weapons or whatever. They're around the world, Central America, Africa, Europe, United States, Canada. And the U.S. government has really focused on that in the last few years.
Steve, I want to interrupt you just for one second about Hezbollah. Can you give us a little bit of background on Operation Cassandra? It's shut down by the Obama administration and its reactivation by the Trump Justice Department?
I could tell you, but then, Greg, I'd have to kill you.
just in terms of a little bit of background, there was this investigation that was done.
No, I'm familiar with – I think you should be careful what you say.
No, this is all public knowledge.
Okay, if you're going to report what the Wall Street Journal said, that's fine, but
I want it to be on the masthead of the New York Times so Hezbollah stops what they're doing. But in all seriousness, there was this investigation by the DEA and the ATF. They were looking into smuggling and shipping and cars and whatever. And the one good thing that Trump did, and this is exactly to back up your point, they are trying to dismantle that network that's fundraising in 67 countries by the Shia organization Hezbollah.
Yes. And I didn't mean to cut you off. Very good agents. I mean, you know, I can say this much. In contrast to the Obama, there was one counterterrorist investment of the Obama administration. It started in the Bush administration in 2002. It was a group in Northern Virginia called International Institute of Islamic Thought. Actually, that started in Philadelphia in the 1980s under Hoki, who was actually, but it moved to Virginia, and their idea was to, and they were connected to Saudi Arabia. And multi-billion-dollar labyrinth of different groups, all connections throughout the world, but about 39 or 40 of them in the U.S., most of them in Northern Virginia, but some in Georgia, including a halal chicken factory in Macon, Georgia. And an investigation was started on the basis of an affidavit signed by a DHS agent alleging terrorist operations, all the proceeds of this labyrinth of companies. And they had the evidence. And they did a raid. They raided and they got gigabytes of information. and they started an investigation, a criminal investigation, and it took 10 years to finish the longest counterterrorist investigation ever, and then brought up, was served, a 110-count indictment had to be approved by Eric Holder's people, that was the National Security Division. It was brought to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, David Criss, who has now been appointed to be the overseer, ironically, of the FISA abuses, appointment.
Wow.
Mr. Criss, this has not been known, never been revealed, declined to prosecute, decided that, and he wouldn't put it in writing, but the understanding was that they didn't want to alienate Islamic groups, even though it were demonstrable, unimpeachable evidence the nation was responsible, had been funding terrorist operations around the Islamic Jihad in Florida. And that indictment was killed, and nothing ever has been restored, and these guys are walking around freely, funding universities, George Washington University, George Mason University, and chairs have been endowed in their names. So it's interesting to see how these terrorist groups have reinvented themselves, legitimized themselves, and been accredited actually by U.S. government officials. Same thing with Islamic charities like Islamic Relief or others that the police forum and the IPT have investigated, right? They get money now from
exactly.
the U.S. government, even though
exactly.
they're
they get
terrorism.
Federal government money. Islamist funding is up fourfold under the Trump administration. It's insane. And with that explosive revelation by Steve Emerson, we're going to have to end the program today. But Steve, before we go off air, how can we find out more about the IPT and your work?
Two ways. You can, if you want to be on our mailing list, and regular email list that goes out to many people, and it's our published articles and exposés and counterterrorist news, and you just write an email to StopTerror, STTERROR, Dan Quayle now, I don't know how to spell potato, but StopTerror at AOL.com, okay, and just say, please subscribe me. Again, that's at AOL, or go to our website, and you can enroll, and the website is investigativeproject.org. And you can there's a sign up right at the front screen. And you can also
Steve Emerson, the executive director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, here on WWDB 860M Middle East Forum Radio. Gary Gamble, Marilyn Stern, Greg Roman, all of us here on the team at MEF and from WWDB. Great week.